you know, I'm going to go through that kind of quickly as I walk through it. Instead of asking you to answer it, I will just kind of give you the answers as we go through. So Matthew is a Jew writing to convince his own nation that Jesus of Nazareth is the Messiah. So that's kind of one of the things we've established before, but I like to keep reminding you of that because it gives us a perspective of why he's writing and who he's writing to. Matthew's also a Christian, and the difference in a Jew and a Christian. The Jews do not believe that Jesus Christ was the Messiah in their religion aspect of it. And so they had rejected him as a whole. Jews were not Christian in their behavior. They're Jewish in their practice. And so Matthew is a Jew that has converted to Christianity when Christ came on the scene. And he's writing now to others that are now Christians. And that's a big adjustment in a person's life to completely change their religion and lose kind of the people that are close and related to them through that. So he's a Christian writing to confirm the faith of those who, like himself, believe Jesus of Nazareth is the Son of God. Our current study is in chapter 23. We may finish that tonight. That's our goal. It was our goal last week when we got through the first 12 verses, so we'll see how that goes. And we might can move on through it. The setting is the final week of the life of Jesus Christ. So that's where we're at. Everything is now coming to a head. Everything, the hostility, the hatred for Jesus Christ, they've tried to get around everything and be discreet. They finally just might come out and crucify him. And that's what they're headed for. So during the last week of the life of Jesus Christ, the Jews complete their rejection of Jesus, and he will pronounce their judgment. That's one of the things that you want to hear here at the end of this chapter. So in the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus kind of first started really preaching there, the Sermon on the Mount pronounces blessings. Blessed is he that does this, blessed is he that does that. But what we find now is at the close of his life, we're going to find that he pronounces woes. Right, so the only thing I have forgot to do is get started, is get us started on Facebook. I wonder y'all what you think you love, and I appreciate that. Just click on the live, go live button or whatever it is you have to click there, and we'll get started. So I'm going to read the first 12 verses because that kind of helped put us back in the context of where we were. But I'm going to start just giving our comments and stuff as we get to chapter, verse 15. So let's read through. It says, "Then spake Jesus to the multitudes and to his disciples, saying, the scribes and Pharisees sit in Moses' seat," which means they're sitting in the place of authority, sort of the chair of a board, sort of type. They're sitting in that place. They have the authority. In other words, they know the words of God is really what you're saying. "All therefore whatsoever they bid you observe, that observe and do. But do not ye after their works, for they say and do not." So if you remember where we was at last week, he's saying they're going to teach you the Bible, do what they teach you about the Bible. But they're going to practice opposite of what they teach. Don't follow their example on that. And so that was the gist of that one. "For they bid, for they bind heavy burdens and grievous to be borne, and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. But all their works they do for to be seen of men. They make broad their phylacteries and enlarge the borders of their garments." And we kind of talked about that. They just make a big show of their religion. That's what that really gets down to. "They love the uppermost rooms at feasts and the chief seats in the synagogues, and greetings in the markets, and be called of men, Rabbi, Rabbi. But be ye not called Rabbi, for one is your master, even Christ, and all ye are brethren. And call no man your father from the earth, for one is your father which is in heaven. Neither be ye called masters, for one is your master, even Christ. But he that is greatest among you shall be" what?
"Servant."
And again, as we talked about that, that's the way to greatness. It's not a punishment for being great. The way to greatness is to be a servant. If you want to be great in the eyes of God, serve people. And that's what we've been trying to establish for years. That's what we do here as a church. That's our heart. That's why we say we're voices for God's word and hands for God's work, to serve people. And he says, "Be the servant. And whosoever shall exalt himself shall be abased, and he that shall humble himself shall be exalted." So you just see God's plan right there. Humble yourself, serve people, and that's how you put yourself in favor with God. You know, and this is not talking about how you get your salvation. This is talking about how that, as a Christian, this is how we really, truly please God. All right, so now let's go to verse number 13. Now, he continues on talking, and we're going to start hearing him pronounce woes. What does a woe mean? It's not what you tell a mule when you want him to slow down. It's a warning. It's pronouncement. So a blessing is his blessing is this. This person is blessed. A woe is sort of a condemnation or a curse that's pronounced upon them. It's an explanation of a fact. Hey, this is a big problem. So notice what he says. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. And here's why he calls them hypocrites. He's not just being antagonistic about it. He's going to make the accusation, and then he's going to lay out the evidence for why this is my case for stating that they're hypocrites. So he's not just trying to stir people up and things. He's simply trying to lay out, woe to them, scribes and Pharisees. He's giving, really, a warning unto them. Remember everything that Jesus has done? He's been warning these people. He's been lovingly, patiently trying to get people to change their mind about rejecting him. And so now he gives a warning about him. He says, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. And here's why. For ye shut up the kingdom of heaven against men. For ye neither go in yourselves, neither suffer ye them that are entering to go in. And so what Jesus is saying here is that the scribes and Pharisees, knowing the Bible, having the Word of God, it was their job to use that as a key to unlock the door of heaven for people. In other words, to lead people, to bring somebody to Christ, to bring them to God, and be able to lead them there. Remember that Jesus is basically, we see with Peter, he gives him the keys of the kingdom of heaven. It's this opportunity, this knowledge that says, hey, here's how a person is to be saved. Here's how a person is to come to Christ. But yet we find that in that, they refuse to do it. And so there, he says, you're not only not going to enter in yourself, you're going to block the door. You're going to make sure no one else gets in either. And that's what he's talking about here with their hypocrites. They should be leading people to God, but at the same time, they're not doing that. So verse number 14. So he says again, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees. What's the next word?
Hypocrites.
Now again, not a word of just throwing things out there and calling people names. He's explaining, this is what you are. He's trying to hold a mirror up for them to see, if that makes sense. And sometimes people see this and they think, Jesus is just one of those, and he's just really getting at them, But really, he's trying to hold a mirror for them to see, this is what you are. This is what you're doing. This is what you need to make a change from. And so he says, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayer. Therefore ye shall receive the greater damnation. So he puts a couple of things in here with us. One, their job was to look after the widows and the orphans and all these. It's their job that these widows and all should feel this comfort. God had set up a system. You look into the Old Testament, there was a system that covered poor people. It wasn't a welfare system like we would understand it today, but it was a system where they were still provided for, cared for, where they were, they worked, but there was a place for them to work. There was a shelter for them, if you would, in a sense. But he says here, what do? They take advantage of it. And then he goes on and says this, for a pretense, you make a long prayer. Therefore, you shall receive the greater damnation. Remember what he's been saying all along? Everything they do in their religion is what? It's for people to see them and feel a sense of amazement and shock for them, right? That, oh, wow, look at them. And so when they would get up to pray, they would pray these really big prayers and long prayers. Now, there is absolutely nothing wrong with a long prayer. What was the problem then? If God's not saying, because I know some people would love to take this that we should only pray short prayers, right? But that's definitely not what he was saying. So what's the problem with their long prayers?
A lot of words with no feeling behind it.
Okay, a lot of prayer, no feeling behind it. What else do we have? Because I heard something else as well. It's not a prayer that's being done for God. It's a prayer being done for the people. It's a prayer that was not lifting. When we pray, our prayers should be, one, directed to God, not for people to hear. And when we pray, our prayers should be for what people do hear, pointing them to God. And yet we don't, here their motive was about praying, really put on a show. I have found it very difficult, and you do too. You can see sometimes, like, one of the hardest things for a Christian to do is to pray in public. If you call on to pray about something, we see that here, I give a whole idea. This way, I just lay out all kinds of stuff and just dump it on somebody that I hear when you get started and you pray. You pray for all the stuff I just talked about for the last half hour, you know, and carry the mood and the spirit of everything that I was talking about in and all. And you can just see the look on people's faces like, oh man, sure hope I don't mess this up, you know. And I've been in some big meetings and stuff before, you know, and someone will call me and pray to open up a meeting here. And it's hard to not think about people are listening to me. So as a Christian, God's looking at the sincerity of our prayer to Him, not that we should never pray to impress anyone else that's listening to us. And I think that you know me well enough now that that's something we stress around here all the time, is you just being you when you pray. I wish, and one thing I like about having our young people pray at an early age and stuff like this is that they're pretty good at being themselves, and I never want them to learn how to pray simply by learning a new language. You know, I don't think our prayer language needs to sound so different than our everyday language. I think we need to be respectful. I don't think we need to use slang while we're praying to God. But we also shouldn't, you know, there's no reason for us to go back into the 1800s and start pulling from the language back then that we don't use today either. Be you. Be real. And sometimes a prayer is really simple. But here, he condemns them because their prayer was about show. And I'm just thinking about that because how many times, if you're in church for a long period of time, and you're in different places, you're going to experience people that they're not trying to just do it for show, but they're going to be thinking. And sometimes people do. There's a voice that changes. You know, you hear somebody, you call somebody to pray, and all of a sudden you bow your head, and that person starts praying. You're like, who is doing that? Never heard that voice before. And, you know, we change our voice. We change the wording that we use and stuff. And be real. He's not concerned with how long the prayer was. He said, I don't want them to pray a long time in order to try to impress people. And so you can pray. If you're being real, you'll know when to close the prayer. You really will. You'll know when to close it out. I remember... I'll just give you some things. This is just examples of places again. Then I got to move on. This we're not going to get through it all. But just kind of show you just different experiences. I've been in places, you know, like I said, you full buildings, places of prayer. There's nothing wrong with all this stuff. And here, if I call, when we call on Dale to pray, whose voice did you hear? Dale's. You know, there are some places where their custom is we'll call on Dale to pray. As soon as he starts praying, everyone, right? Not everyone else, but the majority of the people in the room will also start praying. Out loud. And I've been there before, and I remember being called on when I was young as a pastor, and I was like, Lord, I really don't want to mess this up, right? You know, and then everyone else starts praying, and whatever I'm saying is not even being heard. You know, like I can't even hear what I'm saying. It's just and here's the hard part. Even though no one can hear you now, you still have to be the last person praying. So as it slowly starts to fade out, you know what I did? Stop, and then slowly starts playing out. I just kind of start up again because, yeah, because after so long, I've been saying the same thing to God three or four times. So, I mean, but I'm just trying to show the different environments that can make it difficult to just be genuine and real when you pray. For those people that are accustomed to that, it's not hard at all. But could y'all just, we'll do an experiment one time. We'll just do that and let all y'all kind of figure out what that's like. It's interesting. There's nothing wrong with it, it's what they're used to. But in here, there'd be a lot of pressure sometimes to feel like, wow, I got to make sure I say the right thing. And one of my prayers I had for years is when I would probably get the opportunity to pray publicly and just ask God, help me just talk to you and just focus on you. And that's helped me tremendously. And that's what I've always tried to pass on to you. So here, he calls them hypocrites because of their pretense of prayer. All right? So you're seeing again what they're doing. What he's calling them out on is not being real in the religious actions. That still happens today. It can happen in here if we're not careful. Being real means don't be mechanical. Challenge yourself. Whatever we do, change it to where it's not mechanical. And that's why we've done communion different every time. We don't ever want to just fall through. And so that's what he's showing. Verse number 15. We've got a long way to go, y'all. Let's go. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye compass sea and land to make one proselyte, and when he is made, you make him twofold more the child of hell than yourselves. He's using a description here. You have to compass sea and land, which means you go through every boundary. For the Jew, what he's saying is you will go outside of your borders to make a convert to Judaism. And you'll trap him in legalism. But once you've converted him, he says, you haven't benefited him. What did he say? You make them what? A twofold child of hell, which means what? He was already, those people that were outside of that religion that didn't know God, they were already, being a child of hell means that's where you're going. That's what you are. That's what you're part of. Now they come and they're seeking for something real, but they don't get it. So he says, you're a twofold. In other words, you've missed it twice. And so their acts of religion have actually condemned me. And I want to say this. This still happens today too. It happens in Christian churches. And not being critical, it happens in Baptist churches. When we use legalism instead of the gospel for teaching people about Christ, when we try to conform a person's outward behavior rather than their inward heart, then we're doing exactly what the Bible says here, and it happens all the time. It has become the new norm for Christianity in some places, and that's what we guard against. That's what we stand against, is to put the legalistic views and things upon people and try to conform them on the outside first and not worry about the heart, even though we think we've got the heart covered sometimes. And he's going to continue to unfold this as he goes through. Verse 16 says, woe unto you, ye blind guides, which say, whosoever shall swear by the temple, it is nothing. But whosoever shall swear by the gold of the temple, he's a debtor. In other words, if they made a pledge and they swore by the temple, then they come back and say, well, I just swore by the temple so I can break my pledge. You ever hear someone make a promise and then they say, oh, see, I have my fingers crossed? I don't know if people just don't do that, but I remember when I was little, people promise you something, then they say, oh, I have my fingers crossed. I thought, what in the world does that mean, right? I mean, if you had your fingers crossed, you still made the promise. But see, in their mind, if I have my fingers crossed, I don't have to honor my word. Biblical or not biblical? Not biblical, right? And that's a picture of what he's talking about here. They swear by, but they had their fingers crossed because they selected that they swore by the temple, but not by the swear by the temple. It's nothing but whosoever should swear by the gold of the temple. Then that's real serious stuff right there. That you can't go back on. And it keeps going. Ye fools and blind. For whether is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? What he's saying is, when you swore by the temple, that's more sacred than the gold. The gold, the only reason the gold was sacred is because it was what? The gold in the temple. But he's saying you got the whole thing backwards anyway in what you're doing. I know that doesn't fit with us a lot in our thinking, but there's still people that's like this in a sense. They make these promises, but they're trying. This group respected the gold of the temple more than the temple itself. There's people that respect the functions and the workings and the traditions of the church more than what the church represents itself, and that's Christ. In Christianity, and the teaching of the Bible. Some people are pledge more allegiance in their life to the traditions of their faith than the Bible that should dictate our traditions. And you can see that throughout. And so that's what he's warning against. So he says, whosoever shall swear by the altar, they say that's not. But whosoever shall swear by the gift that is upon the altar, he is guilty. Well, of course, he goes back and calls them fools and blind. For whether is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift? That makes sense, right? And so we're giving to God. Now he goes on. He says, whoso therefore shall swear by the altar sweareth by it and by all things thereon. In other words, it's all combined. Again, don't get too hung up on the things that's out of date for us, but understand he's saying you are picking and choosing aspects of your religion over top of the person, the God of your religion. And he's going to give another example. Whosoever shall swear by the temple, swear by it, and by him that dwelleth therein. Who's that?
God.
And Church ought to be sacred, not because it's beautiful, not because it's because this building that we're in right now represents the place where we meet with God. That's why it's important. That's why it's sacred. He says, and he that shall swear by heaven shall swear by the throne of God, and by him that sitteth thereon. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, causing what again? For ye pay tithe of mint, anise, and cumin, and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. These ought ye to have done, and not to leave the other undone. So he doesn't get them off the hook. Here's what they were doing. The herbs, you familiar with like little herbs and just the little bitty small plants. So they pay their tithes. Of course, you know, their tithes came off of crops. That makes more sense to us. You know, but they were tithe off their crops all the way down to 10% or whatever of the smallest little things that they grew. They made a big show about how they did that. You know, they want to make sure you understand and know I'm tithing on this, even the minutest part. In other words, they're going through great length, to great detail, to make sure they give God his due in the smallest matters of things. But what did he say he left out? He said the weightier, the greater, the more important things. Matters of the law, what are they? Judgment, mercy, faith. And you missed the whole point. For us today, it would be like this. And we know that this is true. There's people that are Christians, and they make a show of everything they do outwardly because they believe that that's exactly why God blesses them or what God's looking for, but they miss out on love. Caring about people. I was in a conversation yesterday, and me and Christian talked about it several times because in our 20 years of pastoring here, we've gone to meetings all over. I remember one example that's happened multiple times. One example particularly was at this meeting this guy got up. If he was talking to you right now, you'd be talking about this. He was very kind, very nice. He got up to preach, and as soon as he got up to preach, the very first words come out of his mouth, his face meet the term. I mean, really, truly, Dale, honestly, as red as your shirt right now. And my wife, being the nurse, sit there, and she was ready to leave. She's like, this guy's getting ready to have a stroke, and I'm not going to be around to go to CPR. But he immediately, and he's not the only one. People get into the pulpit, and all of a sudden they don't share the kindness. There's not a respect for the people that's here. There's a harshness and a roughness to the way that they talk, and you don't sense that they care about people. And that's what was happening here. He says you tithe. I mean, you get all of your religious things together, but you lost the whole aspect of loving people. There's churches and there's Christians today because of their culture, because of what they grow up in. They struggle because it to them, being right with God means you dress a certain way and you do things a certain way. And they're antagonistic towards people that don't. They don't know what to do with them. They see them as good people, they like them, but yet they're different than they are. And yet here he's teaching, hey, you've missed the part of Christianity, you miss the part of religion that's about loving and caring about people. When we do church here, it needs to be about people. That's where our Christianity is. That's how we reflect Christ, is that, you know, he was a friend of sinners. He never participated in our sins, so that's not at all what that's talking about, nor what we're talking about. But it's about loving and caring and seeing people as people. And so as we see that, that's what he was calling them hypocrites about. Verse 24 says, "You blind guides, when straining a gnat and swallow a camel." Give him a big illustration here. So you, the smallest little things, he said, you just struggle over. You just got, you know, all this, but you just swallow a camel. In other words, these big things, and he's just showing the hypocrisy or the fact. When we talk about hypocrisy, we're not talking about people that's trying to be a hypocrite. That's why I said he's trying to hold a mirror and say, look, you need to see yourself for who you are. You know, hypocrites, when Christians are, when we're talking about hypocrites, and when the Bible's talking about hypocrites, it's not talking about people that get up and say, can't wait to go trick a bunch of people or that. You know, it's people that feel inside that they're doing right, but they're missing it. And that's what Jesus was doing with them. He's trying to hold this mirror up, saying, look, you need to see yourself for who you really are. You're doing all of these religious things, but you're missing the mark of what you're supposed to do. supposed to be doing. And so he says in verse 25, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye make clean the outside of the cup and of the platter, but within they are full of extortions and excess." Now, we don't use the word extortions and excess a whole lot anymore, but we put the context together pretty good and realize he says you make the outside of the cup clean, but you didn't clean the inside of it. So if you went to somebody's house and, you know, they want to offer you something to drink and they pick up this really dirty mug, they say, "Well, don't worry, I'm going to wash it," and you watch them over there and they just scrub everything down on the outside and then they fill it up and hand you something, or you want to drink it? They give you a plate and tell you, let me use this. I just ate off of it. My dog just ate off of it. But, you know, let me wash it for you. They clean all the bottoms and stuff up and the sides off and plop your food down on it. And are you going to eat it? Now, some of y'all are like making some really bad faces over there. So I don't know if it's because you're just thinking about that or you've been somewhere where people have done that. So Jesus is saying to them that's what they're doing with their life. You're cleaning up the outside. But the inside's never been changed. And it's very true. So many times people are accepting others as Christians because of what they see on the outside, even though the inside is obviously not changed. Obviously not changed. God's not looking for you to just fix up the outside of you. One of the reasons, and I don't say a lot about it, but one of the reasons that we did change things here, and I've been asked about it by people outside of the church, and one of the reasons that we don't dress up in our Sunday best all the time is because we saw what it was doing to people outside, we saw what it was doing to people here, where people started feeling like, well, as long as I put this on, so at the church, it kind of balances out all my behavior and my habits and my talk and my language, and you got this right. And he said, that's exactly what's happening. He that mirror of it says, look, on the inside, nothing's changed. Got to be real. Learn to worship God and learn to honor God, because what God's looking at is our heart. He wants us to be genuine with Him, sincere. Some people just come to church and they feel like that's going to balance everything in their life that they've done. That they're doing. It doesn't balance things. God's saying you got to change the inside. He says, "Thou blind Pharisee, cleanse first that which is what?
Within
the cup and platter. That the outside of them may be clean also." Start in the heart. Clean up that heart and live your life honoring God from within. And He'll reflect on that. He says, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees." Hey, y'all, we might make it. Stay with me a little while. "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye are like unto whited sepulchres, which indeed appear beautiful outward, but within full of dead men's bones and of all uncleanness." Now, we don't talk about whited sepulchres, so what do we do with that? Well, the idea is this, that when they had their tombs, because we use graves, when they didn't do graves, they had tombs. When they had those tombs, you know, they would whitewash the outside. You know, because there was a ceremonial uncleanness. If you touched the dead body, you were ceremonially unclean. If you touched the tomb of where they were, it was ceremonially unclean. So they wanted to make sure that they decorated those really nice and pretty, and they also was a good warning sign not to touch that. Don't go there. You will be unclean if you go in there. So they would mark it, but they would decorate it. They would keep it nice. And what he's saying is you've gotten so accustomed and you've made everything look nice on the outside, but what's on the inside? Dead man bones. We use vaults today to bury people, right? There's a casket, and the casket goes in the vault, and the vault goes in the ground. You could dig up that vault 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now, and you could take that casket out, and that casket that you paid way too much money for is going to come out, and it's going to look really nice and pretty. But what happens if you open it up? Anything nice and pretty on the inside, is it? When we picked up my dad's, the guy said he was a particular one he had and stuff, and you just got to know my dad, but the guy said, "No, we got what we can sell you a little bit cheaper," he said, "but it hasn't been. Now it's on the back side." And I said, whoa, that's okay. He said, "Really?" I mean, it's just a small dent. You can't. I said, "No, look, if you could put some duct tape on it, that would be perfect for my dad. And then some duct tape." I said, that would just fit him perfect. He would love that. Like, that's what he would prefer. You know, if If he knew we were putting him in a dented up one and got a discount on it, just slap some duct tape on him and he would be so pleased with us, you know. So, but these guys, he's just saying the same thing. You make it all look pretty, but it doesn't change what's on the inside. So we just kind of have another way of emphasizing the same thing. Even so, ye also outwardly appear righteous unto men, but within ye are full of what? Hypocrisy and iniquity. It says you have made yourself look good on the outside to people, but inside, you're just corrupt. And here's what we know to be true. And churches all across America, ours is not exempt from having these things happen as well. Religion is guilty sometimes of getting people to conform to something and then they feel better about the relationship with God. When it's about changing, about repentance, turning away from sin, turning unto God in our heart, loving God, loving people. That's what God is looking for. And so we have to be careful, and that's what we focus on trying to be here. Be real, be genuine, love God, love people. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and varnish the sepulchres of the righteous. Now, this is going to be interesting. It says you build. In other words, these prophets that have been dead for a very long time, he says you are really making a big shrine of their tombs, okay? That doesn't sound like a bad thing, does it? It's not. In and of itself, that's not a bad thing. They're honoring those. Think about Arlington Cemetery, or think about the grave of the unknown soldier. What do? They honor that thing. He says, you're honoring the graves of the prophets, but here's where you're going to turn the tables on them. And you say, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers of them in the blood of the prophets. They're decorating these graves, they're honoring these graves, but who put the people in the graves? Their ancestors. That's what they're saying. If we had lived in the time of our ancestors, we would not have took part in killing these prophets. We're honoring these prophets. Jesus turns the table by doing this. Wherefore, ye be witnesses unto yourselves that ye are the children of them which kill the prophets. He says, you have just admitted through that you are the descendants of those that killed these prophets, which means you're like them. Matter of fact, you're going to kill who? Someone greater than the prophets. Even the Son of God himself, the ones the prophets was pointing to. He says, you're admitting that you're sons of the prophets. You fill up the measure of your fathers, which means you have added to the sins of your fathers. He calls them here serpents, generation of vipers. How can you escape the damnation of hell? That's a pretty serious accusation, condemnation. Remember, we're in that final week where everything's coming to a head. He says in verse 34, wherefore, behold, I send unto you what? Prophets. What was in the tombs that he was pointing to? Prophets. Who had killed them? Their ancestors. And he says, you're going to be just like them. I'm going to send you prophets, wise men. Some of them you shall kill and crucify. Some of them you shall scourge in the synagogue and persecute them from city to city, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed upon the earth. This is interesting. From the blood of the righteous Abel into the blood of Zacharias, the son of Berechiah, whom ye slew between the temple and the altar. There's no real good history on who this last one is, but everyone knows who the first one that he mentioned is. Who killed Abel? And here Jesus says, when you kill these prophets, he said, upon you is going to come the blood of all the people that's been slain this way from the very first, Abel, unto the very last that you kill. He says, in other words, you're going to be guilty of all of that. That's a really serious thing for him to be pointing out. It shows us that there's consequences of sin are huge. And that when we do something, we're piling on the wrath. It's continuing to add to the things. He says, verily I say unto you, all these things shall come upon this generation. So Jesus has just pronounced all these things, and here's where you get to in verse number 37. Just a couple verses left. Here we go. You would think that he's speaking, because most people think that Jesus was lashing out at them. Oh, ye hypocrites and stuff. But we don't see that with the tone of Jesus Christ. Notice verse 37, immediately following that. Oh, and that word oh is a word of lament. Oh, Jerusalem. It says it again, the repetition shows the sorrow. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them which are sent unto thee. How often I would have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathered her chickens under her wings, and ye would not. Here's just saying this. I've been with you all this time. I wanted to protect you as a mother hen. You wouldn't come. You would not do it. Remember what I've been saying over and over, week after week? He's been giving them what? Opportunity after opportunity after opportunity to see themselves, see what they're doing, and make a change. And Jesus is not at the end of his life here, this message, shaking his fist at them. He's weeping over them. And that's why I say that what we need to be as Christians is, and I know this is not in our human nature for us. We as Christians should not be shaking our fist at other people either. They're not like us. They don't think like we do. They don't do like we do. Look at our country, see where things are going. It feels like we're in a tug of war for right and wrong all the time. It's easy to just want to shake our fist at other people. But notice what Jesus did. He was weeping over them. Until we're at this place where we are broken over the people's sins and not angry at them because they're sinners, not angry at them because they're doing what comes natural for them to do. They're thinking in a way that's natural for unregenerate people to think. They're thinking like we would think if we were not Christians. If we're going to be like Christ, we need to find a way to be broken with it. Not just angry. We stand for what's right. Sometimes there's this thing, but we should never sit around. We should never demean them. Remember what Jesus was doing? He wasn't just picking on them. He was trying to hold a mirror saying, you need to see yourself. He didn't just call them hypocrites as a name-calling competition. He was exposing to them what they were. And that's what preaching should be doing. That's what Christianity should be doing. It's exposing to people, this is what you are so you can change. Not this is what you are, and I don't like you and I hate you because of it. That's not Christ. That's not Christian. That puts us as these hypocrites. Verse number 38 says, behold, your house, he's talking about the temple. They've all come now this time of year to worship him. He says, your house is left unto you how? For I say unto you, ye shall not see me henceforth till ye shall say, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. Here he's saying, I'm going to pull away. In the Old Testament, the glory of God used to rest in that temple, that tabernacle. They could see. I mean, inside of that place was that glory. That presence of God was there. But they sinned against God repeatedly. The prophets tried to warn them repeatedly. They never listened to God. They turned their back on God. And one day what happened was that glory of God departed from that place. The prophet named his son, we find the word Ichabod, which means the glory has departed. The great-grandson, I believe, of Eli that was born, I believe it was him that was named Ichabod, which just means that glory has departed. God has left that place. They still go through all the rituals. They still go through all the formalities, but God was no longer there to be a part of it. And what we see here in America is people going through religion, but God is just not a part of it. Why? Because it's not about changing the inside and the heart. It's not about loving people. It's about just a dress code. It's about mannerisms. It's about traditions. And God says, I don't have any part of it. And he's left us alone. And the consequences of that is what's unfolding in the world in which we see today. If we want to see that change, all we have to do is get back to serving God from the heart, being real, being genuine, and start. Remember what happened in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah? Abraham asked God a question. He said, would you destroy that city if there was found 50 righteous people in it? What was God's response? If I find 50 righteous people, I will spare the city. Abraham got to think about that place. He said, I don't think there's going to be 50 righteous people there. So what about 45? Would you spare it for 45? And God's response was, I'll spare it for 45. That didn't take Abraham long ago. It's still kind of iffy. How about 40? And God's response was, I'll spare it for Abraham just never got comfortable with that thing, did he? And he went back to God over and over and over. He even looked at God and said, look, please don't be angry at me. Look, no, I'm right where I'm getting on your nerves. But he got him all the way down and said, what about 10 people? If there's 10 righteous people, would you spare that city for 10 righteous people? What's God's response? Yes. Was there 10 righteous people in it? How do we know that? Destroyed. But here's the point that people miss a lot of times. 10 righteous people could have spared that city. It wasn't about how many evil people was there. It was about the lack of righteous people. Don't look at our world and worry about how many evil people are in the world. Look around and say, we just need to be righteous. That's how we spare the wrath of God. That's our goal. With heads bowed and eyes closed, God's talking to you. Facebook. Love them. But I've given to you tonight some things to think about and the idea that God's looking for us to be real.